Discover something new every day. RN.
Hello and welcome to a new week of Big Ideas on RN Online and on your mobile. I'm Paul Barclay. Despite ongoing fallout from the global financial crisis and the impact this continues to have on Europe's economy, the EU continues to set ambitious emissions reduction targets. As December's UN Climate Change Conference in Paris fast approaches, tonight Big Ideas hears from Connie Hedegaard, the European Union Commissioner for Climate Action from 2010 to 2014. As former commissioner, she was the chief architect of EU climate action and policy. And back in 2009, she was the Danish minister responsible for the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen. So Connie Hedegaard is uniquely well-placed to discuss the European approach to climate action, as well as the progress being made toward a global emissions reduction agreement. Last week, she was in Canberra delivering the ANU Centre for European Studies 2015 Schuman Lecture. This talk is part of the Big Ideas from Europe series. Here is Connie Hedegaard.
Thank you very much, Ambassador, for this much too kind introduction. Thank you, Jagello, and to the University for hosting us tonight. It's a great pleasure and honor to do this year's Schuman Lecture. And I understand that the topic obviously will be on climate and energy, but it is interesting to try to sort of look at a broader perspective also when it's a Schuman Lecture. One of the founding fathers of the European Corporation was Robert Schuman, and it's sort of in his name this lecture is being done. And I can tell you, to be a front runner in combating climate change, that is not a special big idea from Europe. But to engage in global challenges is. To believe in multilateralism is. And not only that, to believe that we as a rich continent, prosperous, developed, have a special responsibility to lift more than the poorest countries of this world also is part of what I would call the European DNA and part of the European's self-perception. So it goes very much in line with that when there is a climate change challenge globally that Europe should sort of embrace that and take a role in combating it. As the ambassador just mentioned, in Europe we have had some very tough recent years. Very, very tough economic crisis. And that, of course, has also stirred some debate in Europe on the European cooperation. Not that people would blame the economic crisis on Europe, but as in all democracies, there would be debates over whether sort of that was the right economic policy and things like that. That is only normal. I come from Denmark. In Denmark, there will be a continued debate over EU and what EU should do and what EU should not do. Should we have a common refugee policy? Is that bad or is it good? Should we have a common currency? Is that bad or is it good? Should we have a common defense policy? Is that bad or is it good? You know, that's the kind of questions that would be debated in a lively European debate. But I must say that I have heard no one arguing against common European climate policies. Or for that matter, that it makes sense over the last 30 to 40 years that Europe has been driving environmental policies in the different 28 member states. Europe is no different from all other democracies. Now and then it's being polled. What do the citizens really think? What do they care about? What do they think about EU and the European Union? And it's pretty interesting that when you ask even the more Europe-skeptic segments of the citizens in Europe about climate, about environment, about energy, that would be areas where there is a very, very big acceptance that Europe must have strong policies and must have a strong international voice. Now we are taking it a step further. Not only have joint climate policies, joint climate targets, I will come back to that, but we're also trying now to form a Europeanized energy policy. You can imagine what that would be like, having 28 different member states, 500 million citizens, where normally energy policies have been synonymous with having national sovereignty. But the then Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk came up with this idea that we must also have an energy union, and energy has been written into the treaties sort of behind the European Union only in recent years, 10 years ago. It's because if you want to do energy efficiency, if you want to go low carbon, if you want to have more renewables, then you also need to stop thinking energy policies, that energy policies would not stop at your border. You have to think it as a continent. You have to have interconnectors. You have to have grids. Boring stuff like that, you can say, pipes in the soil and things like that. But in order to make a cost-efficient transition to a low-carbon economy, you must have a much broader approach. We must in Europe have a Europeanized approach, a Europeanized energy policy. That, of course, also has something to do with the fact that Europe is a very energy-dependent continent. We import around 60% of our fossil fuels from outside. Needless to say, that costs a lot of money. According to the International Energy Agency, if we did no energy efficiency, no renewables, none of these policies, in years to come, we would be even more energy dependent. Even during the crisis years, sort of peak of the crisis, in Europe, we spent 400 billion euros, be around 600 billion Australian dollars. We spent that to pay for our imported fossil fuels. Around one third of that amount ended up in Russia because of heavy dependence on Russian gas. I understand very well this is different from the Australian situation, but it's just to put the European situation in perspective. So one of the reasons why we managed last year, October 2014, while still in an economic crisis in many of our member states, we managed to forge the agreement where we set the targets for climate reductions, for energy efficiency, and for renewables for 2030. That was that we also wanted to become less dependent on imported fossil fuels. It is interesting, I believe, that some of the member states in Europe who are most dependent on, for instance, import of Russian gas, you could take Bulgaria as an example, they are 90-some percent dependent on imported gas from Russia. They will also be among the most energy inefficient. There's been a tendency that sort of the prices could go up and down. Somebody else than us Europeans decided what the price of energy should be. That's not a very pleasant situation to be in. So you could say that when we have sort of agreed these ambitious targets, it's because for some the climate target was the most important thing, for some the energy dependency was the most important thing, but that sort of made the cocktail that we went for these ambitious targets, so that we decided that by 2030 Europe must have reduced their emissions with 40% domestic, 40% reduction through domestic actions. That is the CO2 component. We must at least have 27% of our combined whole energy consumption stemming from renewables. And we must have improved our energy efficiency also with at least the 27%, maybe going to 30%. The reason why we could agree this was, of course, also that our previous set of targets, the targets we have for 2020, well, they have actually worked. We are on track to meet them, despite the fact that since 1990, Europe has had a growth in our GDP of 45%. We have had a reduction in our emissions since 1990 with 19%. In other words, We have made the decoupling. We have proven that you can have economic growth and at the same time you can reduce your emissions. How did we do this? I would say that there are sort of three main components. I've already mentioned setting targets. The other thing is getting the price right. Say a few words about that. And then also to have regulation. Standards set up. We are in a single market in Europe, trying to take away trade borders and everything. We have one big market for the 500 million. It makes sense to have common standards for cars, for trucks, for fuels, for windows, for buildings, for machinery, for whatever. So that is also one of the drivers behind, for instance, our energy efficiency targets and our energy consumption going down. This might be one of the reasons and something important to understand that we have this experience back home in Europe that it helps when you set binding targets because that is also reflected on how we see the international talks. Our approach internationally will be that normally in Europe we are not afraid of binding agreements. That is simply our own method to achieve something. And our own experience is that it's not enough to have, 28 countries politically agreeing we should do that or we have the intention to do whatever. If it's not binding, we cannot sort of be sure that everybody is actually moving in the same direction. So our own experience is that it's not always enough with nice political intentions. They really change things fast enough. The risk is that there would be too much stop and go because governments can change, priorities can change, and suddenly you have, for instance, an economic crisis coming, and then you get simply other priorities. That is, of course, a challenge for investors. If they do not know that there is a consistent line when we are talking about, for instance, the energy sector, where investments will typically stand for the next 30, 40, 50 years. Also, I think it's fair to say, not only in Denmark, where I come from, but generally in our European countries, it is a characteristic with our climate policies, and for that matter, energy policies, that it is not a topic that divides along party line. Now, I will not paint it so rosy as to say we are never discussing this politically. Of course we are. But we are not discussing, whether there is climate change or there is no climate change, whether we should do something about it or we should not do something about it. There can be some of the details down in what to do exactly that can be sort of a political issue. But the normal thing would be that whether you are Chancellor Merkel, right of center, Christian Democrat of Germany, or President Hollande, Socialist President of France, or Prime Minister Cameron, Conservative Prime Minister in United Kingdom, they would all say, yes, of course, we have to do something with climate change. Yes, of course, Europe should be at the front doing its fair share. And then they can obviously also agree what the targets should be, as they did last October. Of course, on the House, exactly how to do it. There, you can sometimes have the discussions, as I mentioned. But there, we would not, from the EU side, say there's only one way to do it. There will, of course, have to be flexibility for each individual member state, depending on their situation, depending on their energy mix, and so on and so forth. Then some of you might think, okay, sounds nice, but how is it with Europe's economy? Did these fine policies not sort of undermine their economic strengths? Was it not too expensive for Europe? Do they not have very high energy costs? And it's interesting to note that, yes, we have relative high energy prices, at least in some of our member states, but energy costs and energy prices are not necessarily the same. We have high energy prices because our politicians have decided that you can put a price on carbon, you can price pollution, you can tax energy in order to incentivize to use less energy. But actually, it is a fact that if you look at the different countries where you have a huge component of renewables, you can see that the cost of producing energy generally has gone down. Why is that? Because the old energy monopolies, suddenly got competition from renewables energy providers so that you had more competition into our energy systems. You are probably also, both yourself, had the discussion on carbon leakage, and you have heard about this discussion internationally and also with Europe. Is it not so that if you have ambitious climate policies and not the whole world, and the whole world does not necessarily have that, then you risk losing jobs? That is, of course, something you have to be very sort of alert of. What is the exact balance? How far can you go? And it's, of course, clear that Europe very much wants the whole world to agree an international framework so that all countries, also all our competitors, will have to do something to combat climate change. But it is interesting, isn't it, that we can see today that the green technologies, the renewable sector, the energy efficiency sector, environmental standard and goods, have actually contributed to net job creation in Europe. In Europe today, we have 4.2 million jobs in the eco industries. And if you take only a compare since 2008, where the economic crisis started, almost 500,000 jobs have been added in the renewables sector only. 500,000 jobs. That's not a small figure. It's a very substantial figure. Well, climate policies are often blamed in Europe for lots of things. I know that happens in many places. But the fact is that Europe has become one of the world's most energy efficient regions after Japan, the region in the world that gets most output out of less energy input. That is not bad, I will argue, for competitiveness in a region that is extremely dependent on imported fuel from outside and a region which is extremely dependent on raw materials input. Now, to make these ambitious policies, not only to adopt them, but also actually to implement them, it's definitely no walk in the park. I mean, we are no different from all other economies. There would be many people and interests and businesses advocating we should just continue business as usual. There would also be those who would ask, but what does it help if Europe is a front runner? Is anybody following? I think there it's interesting to see what has happened, and I do not know if I dare mention this dirty word, with the emissions trading scheme in Europe. But actually, we thought that if we have in a cost-efficient manner to combat climate change, then we need to use a market-based system. That was why the emissions trading scheme was invented in Europe. And it's interesting today to see that Korea has adopted a scheme. China has 7 pilot schemes up running for regions for 250 million people. And it's generally expected that when next year we see the next Chinese 5-year plan, they will have sort of a vision for it and a date for it when they are doing a national price on carbon and national emissions trading scheme. And in Europe, we have been helping China to develop this. You could see it in Chile. You could see it in 20-some American states now having some way or the other actually to price carbon. So that's just one example that if you start something, it sometimes takes a while before others follow, but actually others do follow. If you take the climate policies that we defined a decade ago and in the run-up to the climate conference in Copenhagen, after that, more than 90 countries have now set their own climate policies and goals. Today we have, prior to the climate conference in Paris, countries representing more than half of the global emissions telling the UN what they are planning to do. And maybe most surprising to many, last year, 2014, according to Bloomberg New Energy Finance, more than half of the energy capacity that was installed globally was renewable. In other words, last year there was more new energy capacity installed globally that was renewable than was fossil fuel. I think that's quite interesting. And that's, of course, also one of the factors why the cost of renewables these years are coming down dramatically. We still hear this myth out there, oh, it's very, very costly, it's very, very expensive. Well, solar has come down dramatically, wind has come down in price dramatically, and by 2020, it is generally expected that, for instance, onshore wind and solar will be competitive to fossil fuels. I would also mention that climate is one of the areas where we tend to believe in Europe that we have some soft power. And there may be not too many areas where Europe can say that, but we are the countries in the world that gives most money in development aid, and I think that we have sort of a role to play in the international climate talks. For instance, that we are meeting now in Paris in 2015, that was decided back in Durban at the international conference there in 2011, where Europe, together with around 100 developing countries, among them the poorest countries and the most vulnerable countries in the world, put the pressure on China, on India, on the US, on others to move their position so that now there is this deadline for Paris 2015, not only a deadline for an agreement, but there was agreement 4 years ago that this agreement should be characterized by putting down the artificial sort of division between countries that are developed, those who were developed back in the 1990s, and those who are developing countries, because we think that we can only handle climate change as the global phenomenon and challenge that it is if all countries pursue a more sustainable and low-carbon development strategy. Paris agrees a new setup. I think that Europe deserves some credit for having contributed to that. And I'm sure that the European citizens will say, finally, it was only high time. You could say, how come in these years where the international society has not moved maybe fast enough on these things, maybe not followed fast enough, there's been an economic crisis? How come that climate change policies were not totally dead in the European Union? I think that this also is due to the citizens and the citizens of Europe's sort of understanding that they also have an individual responsibility and that nations have an individual responsibility and the responsibility to respect nature. There is this credo, I would say, in European thinking that we need to leave the world in a better shape than we found it, and you need to sort of have a profound respect of nature. And this, to leave the planet no worse off for the next generation than we found it ourselves, we will all agree that is not a small task with the world we are living in. But I think that this profound value, that we have sort of a sense of responsibility there, that has been a driver also for EU in the climate field in the very tough years, in the tough economic years. The citizens simply expected it, not only from their European leaders, but also from their national leaders going to the different meetings in Brussels and discussing what to do and not what to do. It does not mean that there's not a struggle in Europe. Of course there is. There are fights. There are many, many vested interests that would lobby for business as usual. But I think that when the crisis hit, it helped that the growth issue, the job case, and the climate and energy case could actually go hand in hand. And I think to anyone who wants ambitious climate policies, it is absolutely imperative that the jobs and the growth story is also part of this. But also in Europe, there are, of course, many challenges these days, and you should not underestimate that if Paris, the International Climate Conference in Paris, were to fail, don't underestimate that then we could risk to have a new and very complicated debate in Europe. You can only be a front runner for so and so long. There have to be followers. Luckily, what we see now is a very different international situation, also after the G2, US and China, instead of this waiting for each other, last November came forward saying what they intend to do. That makes a very different psychology, a political climate around Paris. That, of course, is good. But all big parties need to take their fair share of the responsibility the Europeans would expect, no less. But I also think that if they do, then the world has a unique chance of moving away from the old North-South paradigm, which characterized the 20th century and the way we saw the world, into what I think is and must be the paradigm of the 21st century, namely to acknowledge that we are mutually interdependent. Just to be clear, that does not mean that those of us so fortunate to live in the rich part of the world, the industrial part of the world, those who have been industrialized for a long time, that we do not have a special responsibility. Of course we have, and that must be reflected also in the financial package that needs to be part of the Paris talks. But Europe, for instance, accounts for 10% of the global emissions. It goes without saying that with all major emitters taking their fair share, the world will not be able to make it. Let me finish this Schuman lecture saying a few words about putting this into sort of the more historical context. I mentioned that in Europe there are critical debates about many things these days. And there is a tendency in this debate, where you look at Europe, to forget where Europe came from and where the European Union and the European community came from. It is built on the ashes, you could say, of Second World War. And sometimes when also citizens in Europe sort of point to this or that element or aspect of Europe that they do not like particularly, you know, say, why do the politicians do this at the European level, why this? It is sometimes useful to try and remember that there are really many other possible scenarios for Europe. Europe is a continent that has spent centuries fighting with each other through wars. But it is interesting that when after the Second World War, Robert Schuman and the other founding fathers of the European project thought that there must be better ways of living together than fighting together and going to war together, the first thing that they really focused on was exactly energy. As the front runner sort of for what became the European Community and later the European Union was called, the European Coal and Steel Union. Why was that? That was because energy was at the heart of the project of uniting old enemies. It was Germany, it was France, it was Italy, it was Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, those six founding countries. They had to find joint ways to cooperate on the essential elements in the industrial growth at that time, steel and coal. To provide energy to the economy is still a prerequisite for growth. Therefore, although the European project has developed quite a lot since its establishment formally in 1957, forward-looking energy policies now inevitably also with forward-looking climate policies is at the core of European cooperation, as is taking responsibility for a global challenge like the climate challenge. The challenge is to make growth, jobs, and energy and climate policies go hand in hand. I would argue that Europe is well on track to do exactly this. Thank you very much.
Connie Hedegaard, former EU Commissioner for Climate Action from 2010 to 2014. On RN, online, or on the ABC radio app, you're with Big Ideas. And tonight, we're at the ANU in Canberra. Let's return there for the discussion I had with Connie Hedegaard immediately after her Schuman lecture.
You've arrived in Australia, I think it's fair to say, at a time when faith in political leadership is not at terribly high levels. Opinion polls show that as far as leadership on both sides of politics here are concerned, the public doesn't have a great deal of faith that bold action, far-sighted action, is likely to come. So I say all that in parenthesis and ask you, in terms of what you learnt as EU Commissioner, from negotiating with European governments and European business, how do you go about convincing them to take effective action on seriously reducing CO2 emissions when there can be short-term political problems that go with that that might make them want to avoid taking such action?
Very easy question. Well, I think that when we had to prepare these 2030 targets in the midst of a crisis and first decide, can we do that? Is this timely? Will the citizens accept this in the midst of this situation? Then we were very, very conscious that you have to have jobs, growth, and energy and climate go together. And now I mentioned that we as a continent would be very much energy dependent, have to import from the outside. And I know Australia's situation is different, but we have member states also in Europe who will be more dependent on fossil fuels, on coal, the mining jobs and things like that. So I think that what we are trying to do is, of course, not to change that overnight or in a year or, for that matter, in 5 or 10 years. But it matters, we believe, that if you have the long-term trajectory set, and I think that should be sort of one way of doing it. I believe we have politics also in Europe, and I know you have it here in many places in the world, dominated by short-term thinking. And by the way, media will be, and I used to be a journalist myself, but media is part of the problem because there is a news cycle that is getting shorter and shorter. So how to cope with the fact that we have long-term challenges and short-term policies and extremely short-term media cycle, how do you align this? I have no easy answer to that. I think that there is a responsibility for media that could be sort of lifted better. I'm not talking journalists individually, obviously, but media has a responsibility that long-term policy is possible and that we sort of have a joint public that discusses these matters. And I think that it also is a fact that leaders, they must lead. And honestly, I think one of the challenges right now is that sometimes the political environment thinks as much for the short term as the market. And that is not logical. The market, we cannot do it without cost efficiency and market forces being part of this. But the problem is if the politicians start to think as much for the short term as the market act for the short term, what is then the added value in having the politicians? So I think that we sort of need to reinvent some political leadership. But, and that comes back to media, then media also have to accept that sometimes it's okay for politicians to sort of describe a vision, for instance, without necessarily having all the tools right in the same moment he comes up with this idea. So there's something there to reflect, and I say that also in a country where I know that one tycoon is owning quite a bit of the media.
Indeed. And some would argue that his newspapers are not terribly supportive of action on CO2
emission reductions. I would not call them climate activists. Not in a good sense, anyhow.
How difficult is it to persuade business and government that good climate policy can also be good for business, that there are new industries that can open up, new possibilities? Did you find that when you had that discussion as climate commissioner that people were open to that way of thinking in Europe?
Also in Europe, we have different views, of course, in the business community. That's clear. Also because one of the challenges is that I can come with some figures and saying we can create new jobs, but we might be losing some jobs here, and the new job that will replace it, it will take maybe 2 or 3 or 5 years until that emerges. So, of course, there are real challenges in this. But I think if you ask the big businesses in Europe, big corporate companies, they have understood this. And they have very much understood that it's a risk if their business do not sort of adapt to what will come.
And they are changing, those big businesses?
And they are changing. If you take a big company like Unilever, global player, I know that they are accounting each year what the changing climate actually cost this global conglomerate in lost profits. They simply assess what is it costing us. And many of the big businesses, they would understand this. The interesting thing now is that some of the big banks also start to understand that it's risky if they do not change their investment currents. But of course, If I own
a small company of 100 people subcontracting for, say, the mining industry. Of course, I'm afraid. What is happening to me? So it's extremely important that the decision makers make some incentives, try and bridge sort of how can we come from A to B. But that's, of course, also why we have the longer-term targets. It's not a European tradition that we should sit in 2014 and adopt targets for anything for 2030. But that's, of course, because we know that as you cannot do this in a very short time scale, you need to say this is the direction in which we are going. Then, as an industry, you can adapt. Then, as a society, you can find out we are losing something, we are gaining something, how do we best do this?
So the countdown is on to Paris, the climate change conference in Paris. You hosted the Copenhagen climate change conference in 2009 that delivered such a disappointing outcome. As we prepare for Paris in December, what are the lessons that can be learnt from Copenhagen, which, as we say, promised much and delivered very little?
Yeah, and I accept that in answer to your question, but don't forget that the 2 degrees threshold, the $100 billion per year in financing, and a lot of other things, forestry, adaptation, other sort of rules were actually adopted there. We sometimes tend to forget that. But it's true that had you asked me, and I think most of the world, August 2009, like we are now August before Paris, do you think we will get an agreement done in Copenhagen? There were really many hopes. So what did we learn by too many countries coming empty-handed or with not too much to Copenhagen? I think one of the things is this process where, and that was a European proposal to the UN, why don't we ask countries to come well in advance of Paris with what they intend to pledge in Paris, so that we will not risk again that you have the, you assume, because they sort of indicate that that's what's going to happen, that they will all sort of be ready and come with their pledges, and then they do not come with much, or as we saw in Copenhagen, some thought, oh, if my competitor there is coming empty-handed, then maybe I don't have to deliver what I might have planned to deliver. So that is one different thing, and that's a very important thing, and we saw the value of that. I would say that 1 month after Europe had defined its 2030 targets, we saw President Obama, President Xi Jinping, come out from the G2 meeting and now announcing this is what we are going to do. We can discuss endlessly whether that was sort of the maximum ambition they could come up with, but it's a very different situation from 2009, that the two biggest emitters of the world now stand up and say, we know we have a responsibility and here's what we intend to do. That's a very different dynamic for Paris.
So just to be clear, it is essential that the Paris conference deliver a binding global emissions reductions target.
I think it's essential that there will be some kind of binding agreement. I think that one of the difficult things still will be will the targets be binding, as I explained. That would be in line with European tradition to say if you want to be sure that people are delivering, then it's better it's binding than it's only intentions. But to be frank, we saw in Copenhagen, China and the US, if there is one thing they can agree is that they are not going to commit binding targets. How can we then get around that? That's one of the big things being negotiated still. And of course, one way to do it would be that there would be strong, what we call MRV, how to monitor, how to report, how to verify, in other words, how to create transparency around what countries say they are doing. That will be sort of what negotiators are struggling with right now. But I still have to say, I think that there is a burden of proof to lift for those countries who do not like things to be binding to convince the rest of the world that we can come as far as we need to go with their different model.
Well, Europe has committed itself to at least, I think, a binding 40% carbon reduction target by 2013 based on 1990 levels. Is that what Europe will be pushing for globally in Paris? that type
as
of thing?
As a global target?
Yeah. Is that way out of the league, is it?
No. We understand that would be very differentiated. I mean, to ask China to reduce with 40% compared to 1990, that's not of this world. So this is our contribution. No, but of course they cannot do it and nobody would expect it for them. But this is our contribution. And why did we pick that figure? Because we have also decided, in line with the IPCC, panel on the science, that by the middle of this century, 2050, we have to be with a reduction of 80 to 95%. So we said, in order to have a smooth pathway to where we need to be in 2050, we need to be at least 40% by 2030. And all our calculations showed that this is the most cost-efficient way of doing it. I know that there will be some sometimes crossing their fingers and hoping for some miracle to happen in 2047, and then we have found some fantastic technology. But it's also about accumulated emissions. And if we sort of have to have sort of the best and most cost-efficient way, then it would be to be at least 40%. One thing that might also puzzle people a bit, we decided it should be without offsetting, without buying projects outside Europe. For our targets up to 2020, the different nations in Europe, they can sort of do up to half of their work through buying projects in Indonesia or Korea or an African state, whatever. But of course, if you say that all of us have to go low carbon by the middle of the century and be down at 2 tons emissions per capita as an average, then it's quite a costly thing if you continue just to buy projects in other countries. You could also say with your competitors and help them to the green technologies instead of actually starting to get your hands around what to do with transport, what to do with buildings, what to do with agriculture, you know, the difficult sectors. One thing is the energy sector, but the rest is very, very complicated. And as we also believe that if we really embrace this, that can also give us some incentives for innovation. As we have seen, for instance, with cars, when you regulate cars, you do not kill the car industry. Some still think that. Maybe even some in Australia think that. You don't. You actually make them do more efficient cars. And the European car industry is doing fabulous also when it comes to exports to new markets.
There is a view held by some that it's already too late to avoid restricting global temperature rises to 2 degrees, the outcome from Copenhagen. Do you agree with that?
You know, I'm not a climate scientist, so the only thing I can do is to try and listen to science. And they tell us this. I have a very, very small, limited window of opportunity still. And that's why my sort of success criteria for Paris would be not that Paris is the end of the story and then everything is set and everybody goes home and then we are happy, but that when the negotiators and the governments and the ministers leave Paris, then we can honestly say to one another, it is still possible, it's still within reach to stay below the 2 degrees. This is not a small thing, it's a big thing. Some would say, oh, it's so difficult. Can't we change the target or postpone it just a bit, you know, just like school pupils not having done their homework? Can't we just wait or do something else? And I just think that there was a reason why the leaders in Copenhagen decided the 2 degrees. You can always discuss should it be 2 or 2.2, but it's just when you have troubles delivering on the target that the whole world has set. The answer, in my view, is not to change the target, but it's actually to try to do more in your combined effort.
Imposing a price signal on CO2 emissions, a carbon tax or an emissions trading scheme, is seen by many as a logical market-based approach for reducing emissions. Yet in Australia, these mechanisms, as I'm sure you know, have proven to be politically extremely contentious. Scrapping the carbon tax was a core promise of the current government when they were in opposition, and they were rewarded for that promise by winning government. We have now the Labor opposition tentatively dipping their toe back in the water of some sort of emissions trading scheme. Is it possible to make significant cuts on emissions without
a mechanism like that?
I think that there are many ways of doing this, but I just think that in the end, no matter how we turn and toss it, either we have to pay as consumers through the products we buy, or we have to sort of pay via the taxes. I mean, then there is a lot of interesting discussions about burden sharing and which industry and which not. But in the end, I mean, there's nobody from outside space coming and pay the bill here. And there is a bill to pay. So what we found out in Europe is to put a price on carbon, that's probably the most market-based thing we could think of. Mm-hmm. Then we had the crisis. We had problems in our ETS. And then some also in industry sort of started to sort of voice concerns, should we not do something else? But then you know what? The interesting thing was that when then people started to discussing the alternatives, then the conclusion was that business came to the EU Commission and said, for God's sake, keep the emissions trading scheme, because there was a realization that no matter which other means or ways you invent, that will give politicians a stronger say, that will give less predictability. So among different tools, industry, after a huge debate, we're more united than before we created the ETS, that it's better to have the ETS because it's market-based. Mm. It does not mean that you can never touch in it anyway, but it's the most sort of market-based and thereby cost-efficient system that we can come up with.
Mm. I've been watching your interviews while you've been in Australia, and you've been deftly avoiding commenting on any particular Australian government. I'm going to not ask you the question because I'm not convinced I'll get you to answer it. So I'm going to approach it in a roundabout sort of way in terms of coal and the particular issues around coal in Australia. 70% of our energy consumption in Australia is coal. It has underpinned our standard of living for a long time. There are, as you have acknowledged, particular issues about reducing CO2 emissions when you're in that type of situation. In the European context, though, I understand that Poland is a country that is coal-dependent and that they have resisted EU emissions restrictions in the past. So I wonder how you've gone about convincing a country like Poland to deal with this issue and whether there's anything that you can learn from that that can be applied to Australia.
But, you know, I could give you a long and complicated answer, but I could also just say internally in the European Union, we also have some way of sharing the burden. So, for instance, in the emissions trading scheme, mm-hmm. Poland in the beginning had much more what we call free allowances than, for instance, Germany or other countries. So you could say that there has been sort of a solidarity among states sort of trying to take sort of into consideration what is the situation. If you should sort of transfer that picture to Australia, there would probably also be differences between different parts of Australia. Some are more dependent on coal than others are. But and now the Polish ambassador is in this room. But I think it's fair to say that if you ask some of the Polish industries, some of them would also start to say, we cannot change this coal system very soon. But maybe it's also not too wise not to change at all, because we risk not having the innovation we need in a world that is going low carbon. So there are more differentiated discussions also in a country like Poland. Can I give you another, which is not a member state, but Norway as a European country, heavily, heavily gifted by a lot of oil and gas, and that has served their economy extremely well. Already today, this year they will lose 10,000 jobs in the oil sector. The prognosis is that year after year in the coming years, they will lose 10,000 jobs each year in the oil sector. So now the Norwegian Prime Minister, the Conservative Prime Minister, she says we must try and find other strongholds that for the future will serve us as well as the oil economy has served us. It doesn't mean that they're going out of oil and gas just anytime soon, but they are sort of trying to focus how can we innovate and create new strongholds.
I've got plenty of questions, but I also want to have some time for audience questions. So a final question on aviation, if I can.
Favourite topic.
If the global aviation industry were a country, its emissions would be ranked about seventh in the world between Germany and South Korea on carbon dioxide emissions alone. We in Australia are very big travellers. We are used to the long-haul flight that you have just done from Europe to Australia. We are all used to that flight, perhaps more so than people from Europe heading over to the Southern Hemisphere. What progress has been made toward an international agreement to curb airline emissions? I know this was something that you were working on in your previous job.
Yeah. I inherited a European policy saying if the International Organization for Aviation cannot agree and have not within this and that deadline agreed a way of regulate aviation, then we do our own scheme in Europe. Did the rest of the world exactly love that we would start to sort of make the polluters principle apply for aviation? No. Really, really many forces, among them China, among them US, among them also Australian Airlines, protesting heavily. But you know what? Now you said if the world was, it would come in number seven. If aviation, can you think of a more global sector than aviation? And where this principle about what we in climate talks call common but differentiated responsibilities that we should take, of course, especially care of the poor and the vulnerable states. You know, this does not apply very well for aviation, because if I'm a rich Chinese who can afford to go from Beijing to Frankfurt in Germany, then I can also afford to pay for my pollution. And if I go from London to New York, I can afford to pay for my pollution. It's not the poorest people of this world who are doing international aviation flights. India hated this. And they said, we are a poor country. And that is, of course, true. But it's not the poor citizens of India taking an international plane ride. So I thought that that was really an stupid example of how the world cannot do what sort of the world should be doing. But you're asking what then now? We got a process then, hopefully on track, in the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO. And next year, they should agree how will the sector then come up with how they should sort of, how they should address this. And one of the sort of main solutions at the table is how to have some kind of an emissions trading or way of pricing international aviation.
Are the airlines more open to this now than they were? Or?
I think they were a bit more open in the process. They were so happy that they could reject it. You know, in the end, China sort of threatened. I do not know how much if we did not sort of change this. So we have it still in Europe. It would be lovely to have Australia as a partner there. And I think also Australia was sort of more forthcoming than others when it really came to this. To me, it should be a no-brainer that if there is anywhere where you could start actually paying for your pollution, then it would be in international aviation. But I used this term no-brainer early in the phase, and it turned out not to be so much a no-brainer anyhow.
Connie Hedegaard, former EU Commissioner for Climate Action. She has also held the positions of Danish Minister for the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, Minister for Climate and Energy, and Minister for the Environment. Connie Hedegaard was delivering the 2015 Schumann Lecture, part of our Big Ideas from Europe series. Thanks very much to the ANU Centre for European Studies, hosts of that event. More details are available on our website. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for listening tonight. Back with you again tomorrow with more Big Ideas. Until then, bye for now.
In the course of the last century, we've put 360,000 million tons of fossil carbon into the atmosphere, where it is beginning to affect the climate itself. Now, this is a very serious matter.
This is Lord Ritchie Calder, 40 years ago in Science Show number one. Have we learnt anything in 40 years? The Science Show rides again, and you can download the programme anytime from the RN website.